It's simply easier to believe we are wrong than to act on what we know to be right. Well, aloha, wonderful people. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler with the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me. We're going to dive, and I mean dive right into Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. Latoya Jovina brings us our first story. It's called Maternity Leave.
Auntie Dagny loves you. Yes, she does, cooed Dagny. You're my favorite nephew. Yes, you are.
My only child, Alonzo, was Dagny's only nephew. And since I was Dagny's only sibling, Alonzo's title of favorite nephew was probably safe.
How long has he been sleeping? Asked Dagny.
We were sitting on the couch in my family room while she made funny faces at Alonzo.
All the time, I said. How's nursing going?
Well, seems to be going great for him, I guess. It's saving me money.
Has the doctor said anything about his weight? You may not remember, but Royal wasn't eating enough when she was a newborn. Well, it was terrifying.
How are my nieces? Your husband? How are you? I jumped on the chance to change the topic, heading Dagny off before she asked me about my son's poops. Dagny continued making faces at Alonzo, who stared back at her.
Dagny, I sing-songed. Sorry.
She deigned to rip her eyes away from my son and look at me, her face back to normal.
Royal is back in swimming. London has started toddler classes just to get used to other kids. Rodney's good. Did I tell you about the bandit?
Her gaze returned to Alonzo, and I was grateful because I was certain my eyes had nearly bugged out of my head.
No, Dagny, you did not tell me about the bandit.
Well, things have been coming up missing in our neighborhood.
You mean like smash and grabs in your neighborhood?
Dagny and her family had recently moved into a brand new townhouse community. It surprised me that there was already crime.
Oh, no, she sang, staring at Alonzo. Not smash and grabs, just things coming up missing. Honestly, we don't even know if they're being taken or if we're just misplacing them.
Before going on maternity leave, I was employed as an assistant to a private investigator. While working for him, I learned that people have a tendency to doubt themselves when things are amiss. The wife who suspects her husband of cheating will try to talk herself out of it over and over again. By the time she comes to the office, she already knows the truth. She just wants photographs to prove it to others. It's simply easier to believe we are wrong than to act on what we know to be right.
What kind of things have been coming up missing?
I tried to make my voice as neutral as possible. I didn't want Dagny to get defensive and shut down.
Well, my next-door neighbor is missing a bracelet. The woman across the street says her husband keeps complaining about missing beers.
Beers?
Yeah, some small batch local IPA, Black Viking Zinga beer. She says he has to go to a special store that carries it. He's been accusing her of drinking them.
And she hasn't been drinking them?
Dagny looked at me like I was deranged. She doesn't drink beer.
So there was a neighborhood bandit sneaking into homes stealing bracelets and beer?
Wait, what are you missing? I asked.
Dagny sighed. Well, Valentino rock stud gladiators. I must have heard her wrong. Those shoes Dagny was referring to cost $2,000.
Pardon?
I asked.
You're the one to judge, she replied flatly. My son stared at her, waiting for her to start cooing again.
Oh, no, I'm not judging, but why would you spend so much on shoes when all you wear is athleisure and sneakers?
I gestured to her outfit, leggings, tank top, lightweight Nikes.
I didn't buy them, Rodney did.
Rodney was Dagny's husband and my brother-in-law. He was a hard worker who loved designer labels almost as much as he loved my sister and their girls. The pricey sandals now made perfect sense. "Did you call the police?" "Oh, to tell them what? My shoes aren't in the box and I can't find them?" "No, I'm just going to replace them before Rodney realizes they're gone. I don't even want to know what he would do if he knew someone was in our house, never mind that they took something so expensive." "Let's hold off on replacing them for now," I said. A plan was forming in my mind. As long as I wasn't getting paid, I could still claim to be on maternity leave. "When's the next book club?" At 9 o'clock the following Friday, I found myself at Dagny's house with 8 other women. Seated on Dagny's sectional was Brenda, a stay-at-home mom to twin boys who had brought 3 magnums of La Marca Prosecco. Next was Letitia, a friend Dagny had known since high school, who had shown up with a giant pan of grilled shrimp skewers. Then there was me. On my right was Linda, who worked from home and had taken the time to air-fry homemade mini corn dogs. Next to her was Felicia, a mom blogger and yoga teacher who had brought a giant bag of weed-infused sour gummies. As a nursing mother, I couldn't partake, but I made sure to get Felicia's contact info for the future. On the other side of the sectional was Dawn, who had last lived in New Orleans and brought homemade beignets. Next to her was LaShawn, a single mother of 5, who brought a takeout pizza that had yet to be touched. Inez was a chef and a grandmother who brought buttermilk cheddar biscuits still warm from the oven. And finally, there was Alicia, a married mom who had baked green tea cupcakes with matcha cream cheese frosting. "Haiti seems like such a scary place," Brenda said. The book of the week was An Untamed State by Roxane Gay. I'd read it years ago. "Oh, I don't know," said Inez. "I've been to that cruise port they have. The people there were really nice." "Oh, I'm sure a lot of the brothers and sisters live in fear there," said Felicia. "Kidnapping for a ransom may only happen to the rich, but that's not the only crime that occurs." "Well then, Haiti may be the right vacation spot for me and my kids," said LaShawn. "I don't have any money, plus they bad as hell. Kidnapper's going to bring them right back." A wave of giggles passed through the room. LaShawn's brood must have had quite the reputation. I sipped my Prosecco and tried to think of a way to steer the conversation to the bandit. "If you want to avoid crime, then you can't go anywhere," said Alicia. "My husband grew up in Baltimore. That city has been a mess since he was a kid." "Suburbs have crime, too," I blurted out before they turned the conversation to another country. "Vacation destination or city?" "Dagny was telling me some of you have been visited by a bandit." The women nodded. Dagny stared daggers at me, clearly realizing the reason I had wanted to come to the book club. "My husband is still complaining about his missing beers," said Letitia. She was holding a biscuit that had a perfect crescent-shaped bite mark in it. "Those biscuits must have been moist." I made my way over to the refreshments, keeping my ears open. "I still haven't found my bracelet, but I don't know if someone took it," said Linda. "I think it's far more likely I lost it." I felt Dagny's eyes on me, but I focused on piling shrimp skewers, 2 biscuits, and a green tea cupcake on my plate. "I know last time y'all were talking about it, I was skeptical," began Dawn. "But now something of mine is missing. Remember the Imar Hutchins print of Octavia Butler I had hanging in my office? It's gone. I know I wouldn't have moved it. Either someone took it, or I'm losing it." The biscuit was like chewing on a cheesy piece of heaven. But Dawn's comment robbed me of all its deliciousness. Dagny took her eyes off me to join the conversation about the missing print. Meanwhile, I studied Dawn. Seated, she was looking about average height, thin, light brown skin. Her hair was the color of a freshly minted penny.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Linda. I know how much you love that picture. Octavia Butler is your favorite author, right?"
Dawn nodded. "Yeah, I filed a police report and gave it to my insurance company. I'm not sure what to do next."
"I love Octavia Butler," I said. "Do you have a picture of the print?"
Dawn began swiping on her phone. I left my plate on the kitchen island and made my way to her. On her screen was a TikTok of her unboxing what looked to be a 24-inch by 24-inch framed collage of Octavia Butler. It was beautiful, colorful, majestic, yet comforting. Dawn mugged for the camera, holding the print. I watched her twirl around on the screen in sheer joy. She seemed to really appreciate the piece.
"Well, I had a pair of hoop earrings I can't seem to find," said Alicia. The lady suggested places Alicia could look for them. One had lost an earring while pulling a sports bra up over her head and had found it in the dirty clothes hamper weeks later. One had discovered a lost hoop hanging in her daughter's dollhouse as a makeshift baby swing. Something was definitely happening in Dagny's neighborhood, but I couldn't put my finger on what. I chewed over the new information while three Cheddar Bay biscuits melted in my mouth. I thought about Dagny's neighborhood bandit the entire way home. And again, while I was up in the middle of the night nursing my son, and even more while I changed diapers, cooked, cleaned, and showered. I rocked Alonzo to sleep while I searched eBay. There wasn't any sign of Dagny's Valentino sandals. I made a mental note to search Poshmark. I didn't know enough about the missing bracelet or earrings to even begin searching for them. But the print I knew, the print I had seen a picture of, both on Dawn's phone at Dagny's house and on my phone in my home right now. Whoever had stolen it was selling it on eBay. I put in my credit card number and clicked purchase. I spent the next day and a half checking the tracking number for the print, pushing Alonzo through the park in his stroller and trying to squeeze myself into my pre-pregnancy clothes without success. I was ready for the distraction from mom duties when the print arrived, looking even better in person than it had in pictures. In person, it was big enough to make out all the details the artist had hidden, but I wasn't all that interested in the picture itself. I was interested in the provenance, which was a fancy way of saying I wanted to be able to track the print from the artist to me with all the steps in between. The print arrived quickly, some would say too quickly, until it was taken into account that it had been shipped from the same state, just one county over, in a 2.5-foot cardboard tube. The return address was a street in Dagny's neighborhood. There was no name. Only an idiot would have included one, but this thief was far from a criminal mastermind. I asked Dagny for Dawn's number and sent her a text. I told her I had good news about the print and promised to bring wine. I arrived at 6 p.m. the next day with a giant baby bag and Alonzo sleeping in his carrier. Dawn greeted me with a grin and whispered compliments about my beautiful son. "Dagny has been telling me all about him, first baby, right?"
"Yes, and probably the only," I said. "I'm exhausted."
Dawn's house was built exactly like Dagny's, only the flooring and lighting were different. I asked her if she had kids as we climbed the first flight of stairs.
"Not yet," she whispered.
I made my way to the bar stool edged up against the kitchen island and pulled the bottle of wine out of the baby bag. There were pictures of Dawn, who I presumed to be her husband, stuck to the fridge with magnets. Otherwise, the house was bare.
"Is your husband home?" I asked.
"He's on a rig in New Orleans." I watched as Dawn retrieved a corkscrew and two glasses. Confronting a suspect was one of the most important parts of the investigator's job. If done correctly, the suspect can become overwhelmed by facts and feel they have no choice but to confess.
If done incorrectly, I could lay out my entire case and give the suspect everything they needed to deny their involvement and cover their tracks. I decided on the direct approach, or maybe I was just too tired to come up with anything else. I reached into the baby bag and grabbed the cardboard tube that had been peeking out, the tube containing the Imar Hutchins print of Octavia Butler, the tube Dawn had sent it to me in. "Dawn," I said, just as she popped the cork. "Yes," she said as she turned to me, smiling. Her eyes went to the cardboard tube, flitted to me, and then back to the cardboard tube. The tube was all the statement I needed. I waited for her to break.
Your name is Mo?" she stammered.
This statement was an interesting choice. She didn't deny stealing her own painting or selling it online, nor did she try to pretend to be confused about what the tube contained. Instead, she was accusing me of lying about who I was when I made the purchase. I had to admire her moxie. Nevertheless, she was incorrect. She may have been a thief, but I was not a liar. "My name is Imogene Frawler, Mo for short," I said, "but I think we have more important things to discuss." Alonzo chose that moment to wake up and start whining. I got off the bar stool and bent to get him out of the carrier. Dawn walked toward me, Alonzo and the kitchen island, clutching her giant glass of Merlot in one hand and the half-emptied bottle in the other. When I stood, she was sitting next to where I was standing, her glass to her lips, the liquid inside it disappearing.
"My husband is having an affair," she blurted out once the glass was empty. "He never wanted to move here. He loved his job on the rig, but after being laid off during COVID because everyone else was working from home, he agreed it was time for a change. His brother owns some sort of a company that sells mechanical supplies to contractors around the corner from here." Alonzo was hungry. I was in Dawn's kitchen accusing her of insurance fraud and filing a false police report. We were way past pretense. I lowered one side of my maternity shirt, unclasped the side of my bra, and held Alonzo to my exposed breast. "So we sold our house, built this one, and moved in. Then the price of gas spiked and the rig begged him to come back. Back he ran. At first he flew back here whenever he was off. But lately he hasn't been, making up some nonsense about mandatory overtime. I don't know about the overtime, but I do know my cousin saw him dancing with some girl down there in the French Quarter. She's even sent me pictures."
Dawn started refilling her empty wine glass. Alonzo nursed. I waited, but it seemed she was done speaking.
"I'm sorry about your husband," I said, "but what do my sister's sandals have to do with it?"
Dawn gurgled the wine in her mouth before swallowing. Then she started to cough.
"Sandals?"
"Yes, Dawn. What does your husband cheating on you have to do with you robbing your neighbors?" Dawn rolled her eyes. She was silent, but the expression on her face screamed, "You can't be serious." What she said instead was, "I am not robbing people in the neighborhood. Well, at least I wasn't before you, because I'm keeping this wine and I'm drinking your share."
"What?"
"You're nursing and you have a long drive home, don't you? Plus, you can't afford more. Dagny told me your husband has a trust fund." "I'm not talking about the wine, Dawn," I spoke shrilly. Alonzo unlatched himself from my breast and stared at me. I soothed my baby while Dawn chugged my fine Merlot like it was gas station Red Bull. "Why are you stealing from your neighbors? Are you trying to hire a hitman or something?" This produced a giggity drunk giggle. I was starting to get annoyed. "Talk to me or talk to the police. Your choice." That seemed to snap her back to the issue at hand. "Bless your heart," Dawn shook her head. "I didn't rob anyone. I said my picture was stolen so I could get the insurance money. Then I sold it online to add more to my stash.
I've been getting rid of everything. She gestured at the naked walls of the room. There was no art, no flat panel TV, nothing.
You're not the bandit. You can't have any more wine. How much did this even cost? It's amazing.
Her face was flush. If I had to guess, her stomach must have been empty when I arrived.
But why do you need a stash? Please, just go to the divorce route.
Hitmen aren't the most diligent workers. You're more likely to end up robbed or in jail, with your husband still chasing women down around the oil rig.
Don scoffed. So, okay, sorry that came out wrong. I'm just saying.
I already talked to an attorney. Everything we have will be split evenly, but if I hide some of what we have, then I will come out ahead. I'm getting a head start by selling some of the things, putting the proceeds in a secret account.
Your lawyer told you to do that?
Well, not exactly. Don sipped more wine. This entire trip around the Beltway had been a huge waste of time. I thought Don was the bandit and had stolen her own painting as a way to reduce suspicion. But she had just robbed herself, her insurance company, and me, come to think of it. There was still a thief ducking in and out of houses in Dagny's neighborhood.
Alonzo was sleeping again.
"Your house wasn't broken into?" I asked.
"No, it was."
Dawn had blown me in more directions than a New Orleans hurricane, and I felt like a levee holding it together by a thread. I put Alonzo back into his baby seat. He'd be up and hungry again in a few minutes. I had to make this quick. I walked over to Dawn's pantry. She looked down at my sleeping son and smiled. Then she looked at me with half boredom and half annoyance. The pantry contained boxes of chicken stock, cans of crushed tomatoes, airlock containers of rice, sugar, and flour. There was a 35-pound jug of peanut oil on the floor. At the top were boxes of cereal, but it would have been too humiliating to open the step stool to retrieve one. At the back of the bottom shelf, I saw an unopened box of saltines. I grabbed the box, pulled out a sleeve of crackers, opened them, and set them in front of Dawn.
I think it's been a while since you've eaten. Going back on the market.
Getting it back tight, she said, but she obliged me by eating a cracker.
Your house was broken into?
Yep, but I had already sold my jewelry. The box was empty.
Was anything taken?
Nope.
Dawn grabbed another cracker and shoved it into her mouth. How do you know someone was in here?
The box was open. I wouldn't leave it open. I knew it was empty.
Do you have any idea who it could have been?
Well, someone who wasn't at the book club.
Alonzo was looking up at me. In a minute he was going to start fussing. He wanted his second course.
I reached down and helped him latch onto my other breast. Then I took a deep breath, and with all the patience I could muster, I asked,
Dawn, what the heck does book club have to do with anything?
She looked at me with knitted brows before taking another sip from her glass. It took me a minute to realize Dawn had forgotten what we were talking about.
You said someone who wasn't at your book club broke in and opened your jewelry box, I said to jog her memory.
Yep, it was open when I came back from Felicia's house.
Felicia had brought weed gummies. Maybe I should go to her house next so I could use a lift.
Then I realized Dawn, in her inebriated state, had stumbled onto something. The people who were complaining about things going missing were all in the book club. Dawn had noticed her jewelry box was opened when she got back from book club. The bandit was waiting for the women to go to book club, then robbing their empty houses.
Who knows about the book club?
Well, it's not a secret.
Well, that didn't narrow things down much, but Dawn had helped me by staging her fake robbery. Plus, she was a woman in pain. She was owed a bit of compassion and appreciation, but all I could offer was advice.
Dawn, two things, I began. She looked at me expectantly.
First,
The reason I suspected you was because all the other stolen things were small. Jewelry, beer, a pair of strappy sandals. Things that could all fit in the pocket of a pair of cargo pants. I would not try this again if I were you, but if you do, pick something smaller. You don't want the police or the insurance company to realize the discrepancy and investigate you.
Alonzo finished eating. I covered myself and turned my attention back to Dawn.
Second, I'm going to need my money back for the print.
I knew you were going to say that, said Dawn.
I'm still keeping the wine.
The next week's book club was at Brenda's house. I watched it come to order with a pair of binoculars from the back seat of a fully tinted SUV. Alicia dragged a child's wagon full of hard seltzer down the sidewalk. Dawn crossed the street wearing oven mitts and carrying a great giant pot of what I would have to guess was gumbo. Inez carried a covered basket over one arm. I didn't have to be a private investigator to know there were Cheddar Bay biscuits in that basket. Oh, my stomach growled. I scanned the streets once they were all inside. There was a couple walking a marshmallow puff with legs. Someone else dragged a giant package into their garage. The community was quiet. Then I saw someone jogging. She was short, thin, and quick. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail and hidden under a baseball cap, which is why she was suspicious. It was too late to need the cap to block out the sun, and she was moving too fast to need it for warmth. She was trying to hide herself, and I thought I knew the reason why. A moment later, she proved me right. She jogged to the end of the road, did something on her phone, then a garage door opened. She disappeared inside so quickly I thought I'd lost her. She appeared 2 minutes later, the garage closed behind her, and she sprinted away. Then she did the same thing at Inez's house, then Leticia's house, to grab one of her husband's beers. Finally, she jogged right by me and headed to Brenda's house. I sank down even farther in the back seat. Was she going to book club? She couldn't possibly have been so brazen as to break into all the houses she knew was occupied by all the other women in the neighborhood. Instead, the jogger walked over to a tree, separating Brenda's driveway from her next-door neighbor's. I could see her clearly with the light shining out of Brenda's windows, which meant the women inside couldn't see her at all. The jogger touched the tree and held one of her legs behind her, pretending to stretch. Then she pulled a small green square from a low tree branch before jogging away and using a key to enter what I hoped was her own home. I scribbled down the address and waited for Dagny at her house.
"Sup, Mo," said Rodney, my brother-in-law, and the purchaser of Dagny's $2,000 missing sandals.
"Oh, not much, just waiting for my sister."
"Well, get comfortable." Rodney flopped down on the blue sofa in his man cave. "She's going to come back late, goofy from drinking, saying something about a book she has to read."
I watched the BMF series on Starz with him for hours. He knew his wife well.
"I have to get Under Lock and Skeleton Key by Gigi Pandian," Dagny said as she breezed into the room. "Oh, hey, how are you?" she asked when she saw me.
"Good night, ladies," Rodney said. He lifted himself from the couch, gave Dagny a kiss, and trotted up the stairs. I had to take a deep breath to keep my anger at bay. He worked so hard for my sister and their family. Who was this tiny track star to steal the fruit of his labor?
Dagny flopped down on the couch next to me.
"Some of the ladies asked about you. Did you go see Dawn?"
I doubt Dawn had told Dagny the entire story, so I just nodded and then jumped into the reason I was there.
"Who lives in,
I recited the jogger's address. She looked at me blankly. "Short, thin, long-haired jogger.
Oh, that's Julia.
Is she in your book club?
Oh, dear, perhaps we should invite her. By the time her section was built, they had all moved in. Book club was already established.
Well, I hope she's not offended." I was pretty sure she was more than offended.
"How about you invite her over? Then you can get to know her."
Ah, good idea, said Dagny with a yawn.
If I didn't act fast, she would have fallen asleep. These women in book club sure knew how to enjoy a refreshing beverage or five.
How about tomorrow?
That way she'll have time to read the book for next week.
What was it you say it was, the by Gigi?
Under Lock and Skeleton Key by Gigi Pandian.
Yes, well, yeah, I'll ask Julia.
Great. I'll come too. Just text me the time.
Are you up to something?
I still can't find my sandals.
Dagny laughed to herself. If she comes early, I'll make French press coffee and avocado toast. If she comes late, I'll pick up wine and make fresh garlic hummus with a crudité platter.
Dagny's eyes slid shut. I pulled her sneakers off her feet, covered her with a blanket, and let myself out. I nursed Alonzo Jr. and Googled how someone could open any garage they wanted. What I found was called a roll jam device, some sort of newfangled gadget that was easy enough to make and was also available for purchase online. With it, anything that used an electronic locking system was fair game. That must have been the screen square Julia had gotten from the tree beside Brenda's house. Apparently, placing it there ahead of time, waiting for Brenda or her husband to use their garage door opener, and then coming back to collect it, it would give her free access to their garage forever after. But that didn't explain how Julia was able to get into the actual homes, until I found a Reddit thread discussing how most people didn't lock that door. They felt safe behind their garage door, and didn't want to bother with the hassle of using a key to get in. The whole thing was too easy. I fought rush hour traffic once again to get to Dagny's neighborhood. There were easier ways to break into Julia's garage, but I didn't know how to make a roll jam device, nor did I have the time to order one. I had to do it the old-fashioned way, which was to jam a triangle of wood into the space between the top of the garage door and the wall with the help of a portable stepladder, then wiggle a hanger around inside until it caught the rope release. Finally, I lifted the garage by hand and walked inside. Julia's home was beautiful, but I wasn't here to admire her interior design skills. I ran up the two flights of stairs to the master suite. Julie had the entire closet to herself, and it was stuffed to capacity with clothes and size 6 shoes. I had planned to take pictures of her jewelry and perhaps consult with some of the other women later, but there was too much to search and nowhere near enough time. Instead, I focused on Dagny's sandals. My sister was 5'7" and wore a size 8. Also, the Rockstead Valentino Gladiators wouldn't have a box. Julie had left that at my sister's house. The shoes weren't in the closet. I ventured to the next bedroom, which Julie appeared to be using as her office. A desk was set up facing the window. A chair custom made for her short legs was underneath. There were flattened boxes and folded tissue papers neatly stacked on bookshelves that lined the room. On the desk sat a MacBook and a laser printer. This must have been where she sold her stolen goods. Had she already shipped Dagny's shoes? My palms itched. I didn't want to pay for new Rockstud Valentino Gladiators, but I would before I allowed Dagny to buy another pair. I turned to leave. Near the door were a neat stack of 4 boxes packaged to be shipped. Only one was large enough to hold the sandals. I grabbed a pair of scissors from the pen holder on the desk and savagely opened it. Dagny's never-worn shoes, the bottoms completely unscuffed, were in there. I headed out of the room, down both flights of stairs, and out the front door, bringing the shoes with me.
"Oh, you made it," said Dagny as she opened the door for me. "Julia is already here. Would you like a French-pressed coffee?"
I ascended the stairs and saw the tiny track star up close. She was thin, with tan skin and long brown hair. If she cracked 5 feet in height, I'd eat Dagny's shoes.
"Hi," Julia said, smiling brightly. She sat on a bar stool in front of a crumbly plate on top of Dagny's kitchen island.
Her feet kicked like a child.
"Sure, I'll take a coffee, thank you."
"Hi, Julia," I said.
"How about avocado toast? I can make you an egg."
"Oh, I wouldn't want to trouble you. Coffee will be fine. Sorry I was late."
"No worries. I was just getting to know Julia. She's been here nearly 8 months and hasn't met any of the neighbor ladies yet. I was telling her about the book club. Mo's been before Julia. She can tell you. We all know how to have a party."
"Oh, I can't wait," Julia said.
"Will you be at the next one?"
I knew then she would retire as the bandit. She wasn't stealing out of necessity or even cruelty. Her feelings were hurt. Julia had the height and maturity level of a child that had been left out. Now that she had been welcomed in, there would be no more trouble out of her. I wasn't going to tell anyone what I knew about Julia, but Dagny was my sister, and Julia needed to know my family was off limits. Dagny was busy scooping coffee grounds into the French press and babbling about something with her back to us. I took the bar stool next to Julia and pulled the sandals out of the center pocket of my sweatshirt. Julia recognized the shoes. She looked like she had just received the world's worst health diagnosis. I slipped them back into my pocket and headed toward the stairs.
"Dagny, can I borrow your heating pad? I'm achy from nursing."
"Sure," she said, turning around to face me and Julia.
"You know, you could have brought my nephew. You should see him, Julia. He's adorable."
Julia stayed silent.
"You know, I've been meaning to tell you. You really need to lock the front door from your garage to your house. It's easier for people to get in than the way you think."
Dagny started to respond, but I was on my way up the stairs. I went to her closet, opened the empty Valentino box, and put her rock stud gladiator sandals inside.
Okie doke, I'm staying in the same Ellery Queen mystery magazine for our second story. It's by Bill Pronzini, and it's called Friends. He was the only friend I had in Santa Rita, and I was his only friend after he came to town. Couple of king-size loners, ugly in some people's eyes, that was Malachi Smith and me. Nobody else wanted to pal around with either of us. I'd been a loner ever since I was a kid. My father had no use for his, quote, stupid eyesore of a son, end quote. He left me to fend for myself after Ma passed on when I was 11 and spent most of his time in bars drinking and picking up floozies. The other kids my age didn't want anything to do with me either, especially the girls. They laughed and made fun of me behind my back, sometimes right in front of me. And there was this one girl who treated me pretty decent, but when I got up the nerve to ask her for a date, she turned me down flat. I quit high school my senior year, and I probably wouldn't have graduated anyway because my grades were poor, and got a job at Miller's Garage. Working on cars, fixing them up, was the only thing I was any good at. When Pa died 3 years later, I sold the house and used the money to buy a shop of my own, Knox's Auto Body. Customers didn't care that I had a funny-shaped head, jug-handle ears, and scraggly hair like patches of brown moss on a rock, as long as I did a first-rate job fixing their cars at a fair price. I worked long hours every day, even on Sundays when the shop was closed. There wasn't much else I liked to do except watch sports on TV and go fishing in season,
in one of the nearby mountain streams. I was working on a vintage Mustang the day Malachi drove in his old rattletrap Ford looking for work. He'd drifted into Santa Rita from a town down in the southeastern part of the state. He had itchy feet, he said. He didn't like to stay in one place too long. He was even bigger than me, 4 or 5 inches over 6 feet and weighed about 250, with bulgy eyes and a creased and cracked face like leather left out too long in the sun. He looked mean, but he wasn't. Quiet, easygoing, obliging, honest. A gentle giant. He supported himself doing odd jobs, mechanic being one of them. Business was good, and I needed a helper, so once I saw that he knew cars well enough, I hired him on the spot. He worked hard, never argued with me or the customers, never took days off, or was late coming to work. We got along fine on the job. It didn't take long for us to become friends. He was the one who made the first move. One rainy day when we finished up early, he asked me if I played gin rummy. I said no, I'd never had anybody to play cards with, and he said he'd teach me the game. He did, and it turned out we were pretty evenly matched. We played first in the shop office, then later at my apartment. Not often, just once a week or so. Neither of us wanted a lot of company away from the shop. We were too used to being alone in our spare time. What talking we did was pretty much about cars, fishing, and sports. Malachi was a big fan of pro football, knew a lot about the game. He'd played semi-pro ball himself for 1 year, he said, but wasn't good enough, despite his size, to do more than warm up the end of a bench. He liked fishing, too, and we went out together a couple of times to my favorite trout stream. I asked him once, "You ever been married, Malachi?" "Oh, hell no." "Me neither. Guess I never will be." "Nah, I couldn't get a wife even if I wanted one," Malachi said. "Women won't have anything to do with me. One told me once I ought to be in a horror movie." Well, that was a lousy thing to say. He shrugged. Every time I look in the mirror, I figure, well, maybe she was right. Born unlucky that way, both of us. But Malachi had learned to live with it, and so had I. You have to play the cards you're dealt the best way you know how. I'd never missed much not having any friends, but I have to admit it felt good to finally have one. I hoped Malachi's feet wouldn't start itching again, and that he'd settle down in Santa Rita. But I didn't say anything to him about it. It wasn't the kind of thing we'd have felt comfortable talking about. But then, all of a sudden, after 3 months, everything changed. Malachi didn't show up for work one morning. Well, I didn't think he'd just leave without telling me, and I wondered if maybe he was sick. When he still hadn't shown up by early afternoon, I was about to call the cut-rate motel where he had a room when Sheriff Ike Pappas drove in to see me. It was a heck of a shock when he told me why. Malachi was in the county jail being questioned on suspicion of murder. "Murder?" I said. "I don't believe it. He wouldn't hurt a fly." "Well, that remains to be seen." "Who was murdered?" "Margaret Haynes, bludgeoned with a lamp in her bedroom." Margaret Haynes was a new customer of mine, not one I liked much. Wealthy widow, stuck up and snotty, lived alone at the end of town. I'd done some work on her Mercedes just yesterday. "Well, how'd it happen, Sheriff?" "She came home from a dinner date, around 10, Pappas said, and walked in on an intruder rifling through her jewelry case. He got into the house by jimmying the lock on the back door, and out the same way with most of her jewelry." "Malachi didn't have the jewelry, did he?" "Well, not that we could find." "Then how do you think he might be guilty?" It was a hot day, and Pappas took off his hat and fanned himself with it. He was in his 40s, stocky and growing a paunch. He looked soft, but he wasn't. From what I knew of him, his reputation for being hard as nails in a pinch was well earned. Her next-door neighbor heard the woman scream and got a look at the killer running away.
he said. Big man, big as a bear.
Well, there's a lot of big men in this town, I said.
But none as big as Malachi Smith. The neighbor thought he'd recognized him. Smith hadn't been in Santa Rita long, but this is a small town and he's noticeable. Shoot, he'd stand out in a crowd of 1,000.
What did Malachi say?
That he didn't do it. That he was playing cards with you last night from 7 until about midnight.
Well, he hadn't been, but I didn't think twice before I said,
That's right.
He was, gin rummy.
The whole time he didn't leave at all?
The whole time.
You in the habit of socializing with him?
Well, sure, why not?
So he doesn't just work for you, but your buddies?
Well, we've got a lot in common.
He's a good man, Sheriff.
Pappas gave me a long look, as if he had his doubts, but then he shrugged and said,
Okay, then. Thanks, Jack.
You gonna let Malachi go now?
He didn't answer, just shrugged again, put his hat back on, and went out to the cruiser.
I was glad to see him leave. Malachi was released late that afternoon. He showed up at my apartment just after I got home from the shop, relieved and apologetic.
Sorry I dragged you into that, Jack, he said. The sheriff had me pretty shook, and I was afraid he wouldn't believe I'd shacked out early that night. All I could think of was to do was to tell him that we were playing cards. It'd take a chance you'd back me up.
You'd have done the same for me.
Yeah, I would. What are friends for, right?
Right.
But the sheriff's not finished with me yet, Malachi said. His bulgy eyes had a gloomy shine. Warn me not to leave town in case he wants to talk to me again. He's still suspicious.
Well, not for long. They'll catch whoever did it pretty soon.
They damn well better, for both our sakes.
We had a light workload at the shop, so I told Malachi to take the next day off. Get some R&R for himself after what he'd been through. I was replacing a mashed fender on a Ford Maverick that afternoon when Sheriff Pappas showed up again. I knew right away something bad was going down. He wasn't alone this time, had a couple of deputies with him. He wore his hard, tough look, and he called me Knox instead of by my first name. He wanted to talk in private, even though nobody else was there. We went into my cubbyhole office, one of the deputies tagging along with us, the other staying out front. The first thing Pappas said was, You lied to me, Knox. You weren't playing gin rummy with Smith the night of the Haynes homicide.
Yes, I was.
The hell you were!
His eyes bored into mine with such heat, I had to look away.
You lied all right, and you didn't do it to get your buddy Smith off the hook. That phony alibi worked, two ways.
I don't know what you mean.
You did some work on Margaret Haynes' car that day. We found the sticker on the driver's door and the receipt along in her papers. Is that what gave you the idea?
What idea?
You weren't with Smith at all that night, were you?
There was no use pretending any longer, I said.
Now I was at my place watching TV, by myself. Sheriff, I know you weren't. I had a phone call the morning from a man who lives a couple of blocks from Margaret Haynes' house. Said he'd been out on an errand and was just about to pull into his driveway when a red pickup came barreling down the street and nearly sideswiped him. He had a clear look at both the pickup and the driver. There was a logo on the door. Knox's auto body, and the description of the driver fits you to a T.
I could feel myself starting to sweat.
He made a mistake. He couldn't have seen me or my truck.
No mistake. He wouldn't give his name, said he didn't want to get any more involved, but there's no reason not to believe him.
You think I killed Mrs. Haynes?
No. It wasn't me out there, I swear it. I was home watching TV like I told you.
Pappas took a plastic baggie out of his jacket pocket. Then he took out what was inside the baggie and showed it to me.
Recognize this?
a gold bracelet, real gold. It glittered in his hand. Oh, I recognized it all right. The woman had been wearing it when she came to the shop to pick up her Mercedes.
"Sure you do," Pappas said. "It's one of the pieces of jewelry stolen from the Haynes house. Her name's engraved on the inside, and you know where we found it."
I shook my head. "No, no, I don't."
"We follow up all tips we get in a homicide case," he said. "So we picked up a search warrant, and your landlord let us into your apartment. The bracelet was where you put it, in a drawer in your bedroom."
"I didn't put it there."
"Anyone beside you and the landlord have a key?"
"No, but sometimes I forget to lock the door."
"And some stranger just walked in with the bracelet."
He poked my chest with a thick finger.
"Where's the rest of the jewelry? Here in your shop, maybe?"
I couldn't stop shaking my head. I was really sweating now, so scared I couldn't think straight.
"We'll find it, wherever it is, but the bracelet's all we need. Jack Knox, you're under arrest for the murder of Margaret Haynes."
Sheriff Pappas had a pretty strong case against me, all right, but none of it was true. I was a fool for lying to him, but I wasn't a criminal, and I hadn't broken into Margaret Haynes' house or beaten her head in with a lamp or stolen her jewelry. Somebody was trying to make it look like I was guilty. Had to be the man who'd really committed those crimes, but who and why? You have plenty of time to think when you're locked up in a little 8x10 cell. I racked my brains lying there on the cot, and I kept getting the same answer. There was only one person it could be. Malachi Smith. Sure, Malachi. He'd been in the shop when Mrs. Haynes came to pick up her Mercedes. He'd seen her wearing that gold bracelet just as I had, and maybe that's what gave him the idea of breaking into her house. Easy enough for him to find out where she lived. Her address was on file in the shop office. Still, I had a hard time believing it. Why would Malachi want to frame me after I risked lying to get him out of jail? It didn't make sense. Oh, yes, it did. The more I thought about it, he told me the law wasn't finished with him, that he was still under suspicion. That had to be the reason, to completely clear himself by putting all the heat on me. He was the one who'd made that anonymous phone call, and he must have planted the bracelet when he went to the bathroom in my apartment last night, while I was opening a couple of beers to celebrate his release. Once I had it all clear in my mind, I hollered for the sheriff, but it wasn't until late that next afternoon that he finally came. I was in rough shape by then, after a long, sleepless night. As soon as I saw him, I half shouted, "Sheriff, you gotta listen to me. I didn't commit those crimes." "I know you didn't," he said. I stared out at him. He wasn't looking at me hard the way he had yesterday, and the corner of his mouth was pulled up in a half smile. "I had to arrest you yesterday on the strength of that bracelet, but I had my doubts." "When you've been a lawman as long as I have, you learn to trust your instincts. I had a feeling you were lying when you handed me that phony alibi. The feeling I had yesterday was that you were telling me the truth." Relief made me take a tight grip on the bars. "I did a lot of thinking, and I'm pretty sure I know who did it, and he tried to frame me."
"Malachi Smith."
"Yeah, that's right. How'd you know?"
"He doesn't have a police record in this state, but he does in two others. We sent his prints to the FBI's National Fingerprint Database when we first brought him in, but it took the feds longer than it should have to get the information to us. The report finally came in this morning. He was arrested twice for breaking and entering and grand theft, once in New Mexico, once in Nevada, both times under his real name, Malcolm Sutton. First charge dismissed for lack of evidence. Convicted on the second and served a 2-year prison sentence. Ex-con, thief, murderer.
and I'd thought he was an honest man, a gentle giant. How can you be so wrong about somebody?" Pappas said, "After I read the FBI report, I went to see the judge for another search warrant. Then my deputies and I confronted him in his motel room."
"Did he have the rest of the jewelry there?"
"No, but we found a key to a locker at the bus depot. He stashed the more expensive items in the locker, intended to pick them up in a few days and leave town. We grilled him for 3 hours, and he finally cracked and confessed. He's locked up at the other end of the cell block."
Pappas's mouth tightened a little.
"If you hadn't lied to me, we'd have had him in custody all along. Saved everybody a lot of trouble."
"Yeah, I know it," I said. "You going to keep me locked up too, Sheriff?"
"Now, I could charge you with obstruction, but I figure you've learned your lesson. The homicide charge against you has already been canceled, so you're free to go."
He unlocked the cell door, and I got out of there quick. When we were in his office, he said, "We recovered the rest of the jewelry, by the way. The less expensive stuff? Not today. Yesterday. Where do you suppose he hid it?"
"Where?"
"In your shop. In a box of your spare tools. Some friend you had there, Jack."
"Yeah, I thought.
The last one I'll ever have."
Okey-doke, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying thanks for joining me, and tune in again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.